Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tune.
Go on, tell them you knew me when I put my head through the wall and all the awful things that I'd say. The dying animal. It's not long before, but more than a decade, more than 10 years ago, when I'd wake at night and the sky be red, dying all of the way. But soon, oh, it became much later in time, the hole in the wall remains, but gone is the one, oh my, and I never wake at night at all, but I lay in the given waste until morning. Don't you know me? I am your oldest friend. Don't you know? Thank you.
Hey, this is Darren Bresnitz, one half of Snacky Tunes, coming to you live from LA with Chef Johnny Zone of Helen Ray's Hot Chicken. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I first heard about your truck from my good buddy Kong Fong.
Yeah, Kong's a great guy.
Kong's bow down to Kong. Legendary.
Yeah.
And, you know, my fiance Anna and I had gone to Nashville earlier this year. And we had gone, I took her straight from the airport to Prince's.
Yeah, that's a smart decision. That's one of the first things, definitely, you know, to share with people. Because it's such a magical place.
It is. I love it's like, we don't put your chicken in the fryer till we put your money in the cash register.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I have to imagine they have people who've been going there for 30 years.
Yeah.
And they're like, come on, just fry it up for me. And like, you know the rules.
Yeah.
So, for people who don't know what hot chicken is, which is sort of going to be what the base of what we're talking about today, what is hot chicken?
Well, so, like, Nashville hot chicken was a dish that kind of, like, originated in the 1930s from that same family that the restaurant Prince's. And it was kind of like a revenge dish. So, like, it was this this wife kind of getting back at a husband for
philandering,
yep, exactly, and kind of coming home smelling like other women or something like that, and she just wanted to rip them up, burn them up, you know,
from top to bottom.
Yeah, exactly. Well, 2-day process, you know, going in and going out.
Yeah.
So she serves them some fried chicken that was just loaded with, you know, all the spicy stuff. Basically, I think she had in the pantry, and the reverse actually happened. He actually ended up liking it a lot, and so
that's some unintended positive reinforcement.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because, I mean, a lot of things in life can, you know, happen like that, where it's like, it's not at all intentional that it's going to become this like staple dish.
I feel like all those classic food stories, like the hot brown or chicken wings or things like that, are all from these, you know, these moments of either what are we going to do, or we're just going to try something just because we're in a pinch.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, isn't there a saying something about genuity or something when your resources are very limited?
Oh, yeah.
Like and you
ingenuity is the spice of life. I think that's what it is.
And so, like, I'm sure there's like tons of dishes that, like, you know, it's just like Coq au Vin, for example. You know, they had roosters, these tough ass chicken.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they're like, how are we going to break it down? So wine would break down the chicken and they braise it for a long time. And so it kind of, a famous dish got created from just, you know, I don't know, basics. You know, and her basic goal in that time was to burn the hell out of them.
To rip it up.
Yeah.
And you were down in Nashville, you're doing a stage over at Husk.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful spot.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're, you know, techniques and systems and stuff, it just kind of blew my mind. That's why I wanted to go out there. I specifically flew out there. Like, I saved up some money from working at another restaurant that I was at. And
you want to shout it out, or is it...
Yeah, sure. No, I was working at La Poubelle. I was running that restaurant for about 4 years. Generated a huge kind of, you know, revitalizing that restaurant.
Sure.
You know what I mean? A little bit. And putting some proper systems in that. And so went over to Husk and wanted to just really study their charcuterie, how the relationships with their farmers, how their deliveries works, look at their grain program. They use like an amazing program with Anson Mills, where they get like amazing cowpeas, amazing beans, heirloom beans. Like, it's just mind-blowing. You know, there's one delivery guy who, he had white hair all the way down to like his, I don't know, ankles, and then he didn't wear shoes. And he would walk into the walk-in with no shoes and deliver, you know, it was a farmer. You know, he was just delivering his beans or something. It was just super cool.
Now, for those types of things, because everyone always talks about, it's all about the relationships, who you know, the no-shoed farmer, things like that. But do you find it's also really about the systems in place to allow for those relationships? Because no one really talks about the systems that you have in a restaurant to make sure everything flows smoothly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a great point. I think that you can't take something shitty and make it really good. Mm-hmm. So it definitely does start with the ingredients. Like, so if you have like a crappy, you know, commodity based chicken,
yeah,
you know, that's pumped with water and the water has like a 2% brine, like salt solution to, yeah, it, yeah, it can be moist and juicy, but like after you eat it, you're just going to have like a finish on your palate that's like corn or like just weird kind of, maybe a little like chemically, yeah. You know what I mean? So, the systems, you know, those are really, really important to running a restaurant, making a restaurant profitable, and being able to use, because these higher, you know, cost products that have a higher quality, you don't want to mess them up. You know what I mean? You don't want to, like, fuck it up and burn the whole batch, you know, because that's, you know, $40 worth of beans or something like that. So the systems are equally important. I mean, Thomas Keller has a thing about... talking about execution, like cooking is essentially execution, like, and technique, and then sourcing your ingredients. Right. You know what I mean? And they're equally important. You know, putting a stress on the sourcing, I think right now is it's just really becoming very important to a lot of people.
Right, but no one ever. It's never like, you know, hear about farm to table. It's never like system to table. It's not as sexy.
Yeah.
So you're down. You're at Husk. You're doing your stage, and then at what point? Did you know about hot chicken before you got to Nashville, or had you, or was it that someone's like, we got off our shift, we're gonna take you somewhere?
Yeah, so I had no clue what it was. You know, I did see, I think there was an episode on like Mind of a Chef where Sean Brocco's then eats.
Yeah.
I did see that, but other than that little like, you know, segment, wasn't really aware of it and the beauty of it. You know, one of the chefs took me to Prince's, and it flipped my switch, man. You know, like I was contemplating working in Nashville. I was contemplating working in San Francisco, in New York. There was a few job opportunities that I had, but it flipped me so bad that I'm like, you know, LA has nothing like this.
What was the place that they took you to?
Prince's. Yeah,
it's unlike anything else.
Yeah, but then I got further into it. Then I decided. After my stage, I was like, you know what, I'm booking a flight again to Nashville. No money involved. Like, it's just straight up, like, I'm making no money. You know what I mean? Going out there and doing a stage, it's not paid. And then going out there and eating hot chicken 3 to 4 times a day, not paid. You know what I mean? I was just taking a gamble.
How was the whole body?
Oh, man, I have a joke with people that my creamer, my coffee was Pepto-Bismol.
Oh, my God.
Every morning.
I mean, yeah, that morning... Yeah, the morning after is rough. Yeah. So, hold on. I want to go back to that moment when you had the hot chicken and you're back at wherever you're sleeping. Like, what's going on in your mind?
Yeah.
Like, is it like thinking about like a girl that you just met at a bar? Like, what is your mindset?
During the first bite, you know, that first bite, when you look at it, it's... And that's a huge thing, how we're doing it too at Howland Ray's. It's like, you look at it and it looks so humble. It's a piece of white bread with fried chicken on it and pickles on top. It's so simple, right? And so you look at it and it's like this humble dish and you don't really expect too much from it. You know, so that was another reason why we started as a food truck. Because you look at it, it's a food truck and you're not going to expect too much out of it. You know what I mean? You're not going to expect like a high quality dish coming out of it. You know, and that's a big reason why we wanted to start with a food truck because it embodies kind of the dish. So looking at it, really super humble and didn't know what to expect. I was kind of like, oh, okay, you know, it's just some fried chicken, some pickles, maybe it's a little spicy. But you bite into it, the skin's super crispy.
So crispy. And shattered glass.
Yeah, exactly. And that has to do with the cook time on it because you cook them in quarters. So most people associate fried chicken because of like KFC and all these other, you know, conglomerates. With pieces, so thigh, drumstick, breast, wing, etc., and they're like, "I'll take 2-3 pieces." But this dish, it's cooked in quarters, you know, down to the origination of it. And the breast is on the backbone; the thigh has the backbone still on it, you know. So you cook it longer at a lower temperature, and it's exactly shattered glass. You know?
Yeah, and then do you recook it to finish it off?
No, you don't. You don't recook it. You apply a oil based sauce that's generally most people go like 3 parts cayenne, 1 part dark brown sugar, and a few other things, and then oil to toast it, and you kind of form a paste, and you finish the chicken with that paste. Some people brush it, some people spoon it, some people baste it.
What do you do?
I do like a kind of combo method on it, and then I finish it with a little shake.
I'm awesome. All right, well, we're going to take a quick musical break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the truck and truck-first restaurants and all that type of stuff. This is Darren with Johnny Zone of Howlin' Ray's here on Snacky Tunes.
One, two. our love. Our love let out our love. Walk my fingers up your neck and try to forget why I'm never there. Sigh, sigh, sigh.
We are back with Johnny's Own, Helen Ray's Hot Chicken, LA's only hot chicken truck, only hot chicken restaurant?
Yeah, so LA's only hot chicken focused. Like, that's what we do.
Right.
That's all we do.
That's all you
do.
You
know what I mean? We cook hot chicken and we serve it, you know, different heat levels, etc. You know, there's fried chicken spots that may have a spin on it.
Right.
But yeah, we're the focused, the only focused hot chicken.
So you're in Nashville, you're going back and forth, you're wrecking your stomach, eating hot chicken four times a day. And at what, how early on and at what point were you like, I'm going to go back and open up a hot chicken restaurant or truck?
Yeah, so I decided that probably like 9 months, 10 months ago before the, or now, maybe a year ago now.
Yeah.
But I decided, you know, I've always had a dream of having like that little burger shack by the car wash.
Love it.
I always want to be like this chef guy that's like, you know, from fine dining and stuff, but he's just on a short order grill, you know, cooking, slinging burgers.
If my dream, even though I have no real culinary skills, would to be like the diner, like 12 top.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
With like the flat top grill.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Like breakfast and lunch.
Exactly. And something simple, people can relate to it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no issues with, I just, you know, it's just really good, honest food that's relatable. And that's definitely something about fried chicken. You know, every culture has their variation on fried chicken.
Mm.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? It's like everybody knows fried chicken.
Everyone does.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with frying stuff in oil.
Yeah.
So why food truck versus brick and mortar? Because you come from the brick and mortar world.
Yeah.
Why the truck?
So introducing a dish to Los Angeles mm-hmm. was very... It was scary because this dish is rich. You know, it's full of like heat, mm-hmm. you know, it's very spicy and it has gluten, you know, so it's like, you know.
No, I laugh, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
So many people, you know, do you have any gluten-free fried chicken, stuff like that? I'd be compromising the integrity of the dish by doing a...
Yeah.
Wouldn't you be like, who is this guy? Oh, he's doing gluten-free Nashville hot chicken.
And I would go,
weird.
I'd go, no thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd go, no thanks.
Yeah, it's got... I mean, trust me, like, the effects on gluten, like, I feel it sometimes. It weighs you down. It's true. Those things are true, you know, but in moderation, you know, it's not like... It's not going to destroy you. But some people, they're sensitive to it, you know, and they're allergic or whatnot, you know. But starting the food truck, we wanted to study the demographics of LA. What areas respond best to not only fried chicken, because this is fried chicken, but also spicy, you know, so Nashville hot chicken. Which areas of LA have the best response? Second, introduce it and start building a following.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like on Instagram and Twitter and all that, you know, there's opportunities for like, you could like buy followers and stuff like that. And you can go straight up to like 10,000. Like there's some trucks, like they have like 20,000 followers and like nobody's favoriting or nobody's replying.
Yeah, nobody's going. Yeah.
If there's no engagement, you know what I mean? So what we wanted to do is do a real grassroots start. We like very minimal, no publicist. It's my wife doing all the emails.
Yeah.
And helping with cashier now, but now I got my brother coming in, which he's going to be a heavy hitter, heavy hitter,
heavy hitter.
Oh man, yeah,
yeah.
He's yeah. This I'm super excited for this next week. He starts October 7th, and so it truly is like literally family business. Brother on cashier, you know, chef cooking, and then wife running everything on the front. So we wanted to do an intro. You know, and we wanted to study where it's going to, if we, when we're going to open the brick and mortar, where it's going to be, you know, because that's one of the biggest faults in restaurants is the real estate, you know, like where they decide to open, you know.
And you thought that this would work by being mobile. I mean, there are different people who succeed at food trucks don't necessarily succeed at brick and mortars and vice versa.
Definitely. There's several examples in the past like year or so. You know, there's restaurants that open that were food truck kind of concepts, but then they're not doing so well in brick and mortar setting. It's a different animal. You know, like in the beginning, I was struggling with the food truck. I mean, I was like, man, I just want to get back in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And have my guys and have, you know, the systems in place and everything like that.
Well, I mean, it's different. I mean, to go back about systems, like I imagine it's a totally different system and setup than what you were even learning at Husk and things like that.
Yeah, completely. And you can't, it's like to uphold those same standards in a food truck, that's the difficulty. If I didn't have those standards, it would be easy, like no problem, you know what I mean? But having those standards on things, you're like, one batch of something is over-seasoned, right? Like say you make a collard greens dish and it's over-seasoned. You don't find out till, like, I don't know, 40 miles in Playa del Rey or something.
Right.
What are you going to do? You know what I mean?
You got to serve it.
Well, no, you can't serve it. You say you run out because it's not up to code. You know what I mean?
It's not up to code.
It's not up to standards.
Of course,
you know what I mean?
Of
like,
course.
As a chef, you never want to serve something that you know is not right. Like, for example, you know, the hot chick. Okay, yeah. Different cayennes, different types of cayenne, depending on its age, will be hotter or less hot. So, like a younger pepper can be hotter than a more mature pepper. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so the variance on cayenne is very interesting because I'll get a batch sent to me 1 week and it's like, I don't know, 7 out of 10.
Right.
Then next week it's like an 8 out of 10.
Right.
And it really fluctuates, you know, because we're using a higher quality product.
Right.
In terms of our peppers and spices.
So as a taste tester, like, have you been able to like look at it, see it, smell it and be like, okay, I know how to adjust the recipe or this batch.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We gram it out essentially. So
okay.
So our recipes are grammed out down to, you know, grams. So that helps with things. But then when there's the flux, you know, that one batch that's a little spicy, it's like shit. You know, like you gotta hustle to make it happen.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then correct it and then change it. It's just on a food truck. It's like there's so many moving parts.
Right.
And you can get screwed real quick, real fast. Imagine your fryer goes down. You're about to do like a $5,000 event for like high profile musicians.
Right.
And your fryer's down.
What do you do?
And you serve fried chicken.
I don't know. What do you do in that situation?
I kick the shit out of it and then hope it's going to work. And then luckily what I did with the food truck is I lease it.
Right.
So I didn't buy it. So by leasing it, I have a on-call mechanic.
Oh, that's great.
And he's funny. His name's like Chalan, which in Spanish I think means like helper. Like that's what he told me his name is. He doesn't tell me his real name, you know? And he's covered in grease all the time.
Fair enough.
He drives to the location. It usually takes him like an hour to 2 hours to get there, but it's nice having that lifeline.
It is very nice to know that if you go down, you are not stranded.
Yeah.
Now, you've been up and running for a while now. What has the response been and the organic growth of Hot Chicken? Like, how has LA responded to it?
Definitely. I mean, a huge part of our fan base, which I was really surprised by, is Nashvillians. Mm. And people from, like, Alabama, people from Texas, people from the South, you know, or even Midwest or kind of area, you know, like they just want that Southern vibe. And these Saturdays and Sundays, you know, that we're doing, like people are like doing picnics. They're bringing like gallons of tea, which I'm sure there's like little bourbon in.
Of course. Just a little bourbon?
Yeah. Or a lot. It's like half-half. Yeah.
Half and half.
Yeah. And they bring it, but it's in a tea bottle, so you never know.
Yeah, of course.
No one
knows.
And
just the sweetest old ladies who's drinking bourbon, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they'll bring their tea. They'll you know, have a whole spread of all this fried chicken, all these sides, and it's just super cool. And looking at it, you know, it's, I think, there's not a lot of like Southern restaurants that have that Southern feel where it's just very homey. You know what I mean? Like it's not like the Kraft, you know, vintage light bulbs, you know, like things like that. It's not going to be like, you know, higher end, just homey, you know, very family run and stuff like that. So we get a lot of families and the response has been great. The amount of regulars is, I mean, big shout out to all my regulars.
Shout out to the regulars.
Oh my God, man. They're like so supportive.
Warms your heart, right?
Yeah.
Don't you love that relationship where, I mean, especially when you're making, I don't want to say niche, but this very like specific, pouring your love into this and people who are just like, thank you. Like I have been, I will come out because like I know what it takes to do this and no one else is doing it this way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's awesome. And even to reciprocate it. So they come up and we already got their order ready because we know exactly what they want. What spice level, what you know, side or how, like there's one guy, Edwin, he gets a chicken sandwich, medium, just bread, you know what I mean? Bread and chicken. That's all he wants. You know, that does it for him. And that's, I had it the other day. I was like, wow, this is actually pretty good. Like this is,
now he's called crunchy. The Edwin, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice to have that type of regularity, like you would find like in a brick and mortar, but having that, like, okay, I know the order, I know what they want, they're coming up and things like that.
Yeah.
I want to make sure we have time for one more question. You said earlier about the beauty of hot chicken. Why do you think it's a beautiful thing?
Definitely. This will probably be like an hour long answer.
It's okay.
But, so for me, the beauty of it is its relatability between all these different cultures, right? So like you can get it mild. You can get it, you know, like less hot. And it's just like some of the best fried chicken that you've had in your life. I mean, that's one common thing that a lot of people say to us. And it's, we're super humbled by that, you know, because there's a lot of great fried chicken in LA. So the relatability is one thing. But why I specifically fell in love with it was the heat, you know, really opened up my palate. But it gave me a different sensation than just like, this is really well seasoned. This is it. As a chef, you have all these different textures, all these different, you know, you look at different things when you're putting together a plate. You look at acid, you look at salt, you look at texture, you look at temperature, you know, you look at the visual, you know, inspiration on it. How is it going to carry over? Mm-hmm. For me, this dish was like a perfect dish, you know, like it had the heat, it had the little saltiness, the pickles on top, the vinegar from those cut through the heat.
Yeah.
The bread sops up that magical sauce, you know what I mean? And kind of helps, you know, act like a sponge in your stomach.
A little bit. So not just the stomach taking all the punishment.
Yeah, exactly. It goes to the bread a little bit. And then just the chicken, you know, it has so much integrity on it. There's a restaurant in Nashville called 400 Degrees, Aki. She kills it. And she cooks all her chicken to order. This chicken takes 15 to 20 minutes to cook.
Right.
So her business, you know what I mean, is cooking chicken to order 15 to 20 minutes. And people are so great. People love it, you know? And it's so funny because on Facebook, there's a fraternal order of hot chicken.
Hmm.
And now we're getting some play on there, so it's really cool. But they're all just these hot chicken fanatics commenting on it and like, oh, I had it here today. It was a little too spicy or it wasn't spicy enough. You know, like things like that. But it's just a really magical dish. You know, when I had it, I was like, this is a perfect dish. It's got it hits all the levels that I need to hit. You know what I mean?
Beautiful. Well, Johnny, thank you so much. Where can people find you online?
Definitely. Yeah. Instagram and Twitter are going to be a big driving force, or our website. We post our locations by the week. Most of the time we're at steady places. You know, every week we'll hit Wednesdays a certain area, and every Wednesday we'll hit that area. And then if we do a major change, we will announce it a week in advance.
So people know to get their chicken.
Yeah, it's not like your typical food truck. It's just like we're here, 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 and it changes all the time. We're really trying to develop a following and, you know, just bring it to the people of LA.
That's awesome. So it's all Hal and Ray's.
Yeah.
Instagram.com/Hal and Ray's.
Yeah, Twitter, exactly. Like that. Super easy.
Well, awesome. Thank you, people of Los Angeles. Thank you for bringing this dish all the way from Nashville.
And the support, you know, for it we wouldn't be keep going if, you know,
without the people.
Yeah, man, without the people eating it. You know?
All right, well, thank you so much. We got another track coming up, and then we got our band in the studio here on Snacky Tunes.
1, 2, 3, 4. To middle class New York. big shout out to Howling Ray guys. They just parked the truck for the last time, and we'll be getting a brick and mortar in Little Fork location in Hollywood, which will be opening a little bit later this month on November 17th. So congratulations, guys. Super exciting. We'll happen to be out there during the opening, so maybe I can come check it out. But without further ado, we have Jay Bartel live in studio. Good to see you.
You too, Greg. You look good today.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. I took it easy this weekend.
Yeah. In the Big Easy.
In the Big Easy. Yeah, I was down in New Orleans. Go Saints. They just won. They just beat the Giants with a field goal. Well, and a couple other touchdowns, too. But
is there football? Yeah, of course. Of course, there's football now.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know. I saw November 1st today and was quite surprised. But that's how it goes.
Right. I'm still wearing my swimsuit.
Yeah, it's a good, strong. I mean, it's one of the stronger looks we've had in here. Before you started writing music, you were a writer, and I'm curious, you know, where you got your inspiration from and like how that kind of affected your music.
Right.
Early on, it's interesting to change how you self-identify in your head. So, you
know, absolutely.
How did you, you know, what was the self-identification as a writer, and then how did you slowly transition to musician?
Well, that's such an interesting question, and that really gets at it too, because there's the activity of writing, which hopefully will, it, that would be the reason you would think that one would do it, right? If you wanted to write, then you would write. But there's also, yeah, the identifying aspect. And I think that's how I was socially presented or socially known, or, and the people I interacted with, it was all around writing. In terms of inspirations and things like that, it was something that I felt kind of given to do. And I was interested in the lives of the writers I admired, particularly writers like Robert Creeley and Charles Olson, the Massachusetts-based writers where I'm also from. I liked what their lives showed as kind of being a, not a way out, but more of a way in, like kind of a, I thought I, you know, it was a good way to have a chance at in the world, right? Mm-hmm. It was a way of life that made clear sense to me, which was about engaging with people on an extremely intimate and also very direct level.
What type of writing did you do?
Mostly poetry, because I think especially with poetry, I had such an odd kind of use of language, which I still don't really, even looking back now and reading what things I'd written over, you know, 10, 12 years, I'm a little puzzled by certain, I wouldn't call them choices in composition or whatever, but what I ended up writing was had such an odd construction, almost like Samuel Beckett type of thing, you know? Or Gertrude Stein, these really strange kind of word constructs, and I don't talk that way, and I don't read writing in that manner. I mostly am interested in kind of a clear kind of lyric narrative.
Do you have any sense where the syntax came from?
I don't. I mean, other than I don't want to say it's pretense, but maybe, you know, wanting. I was interested in rhythm and the movement of words, as in writing. Whereas in reading, I'm not. I don't respond much to that mode. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in a statement. You know, like a Creeley line. You know, for example, like being in love is like going outside to see what kind of day it is. That kind of statement. You know, there's a rhythmic structure to it, but it still says something. You know?
Right. Did you perform your poetry?
Yeah, this is mostly when I lived in Asheville, North Carolina, which is 10, 12 miles outside of Black Mountain, where a lot of these writers were located teaching in the late 50s. And I ran a reading series. I had a small magazine.
And what were the performances like, or
right.
How do you feel like that prepared you for becoming a musician?
Well, the thing I admire more than music, or not admire, but perhaps is like aspire to or have an interest in is stand-up comedy, which I absolutely love that model for interaction with an audience or with a public. So my readings would basically be long interpolations about one thing or another, what was happening that day, and then you'd have these really brief poems. And, you know, basically talking with people.
Got it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think about it now that I'm playing music, and especially in the way that I'm playing now, which is almost like a melodic way of speaking. You know, I'm not belting it out maybe as much as I had when I was younger, but I try to recall or bring back what I experienced when I would be reading or doing these other public occasions, you know.
Well, why don't we hear a song and then we'll talk about the transition from poetry to musician.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to play first?
I'm going to play a song called Light Enough. And this is as yet unreleased, but it'll be on an album that's coming out in the spring of 2016.
Tonight a blue balloon blew by me on the sidewalk, pushed by the wind, past the lampposts and the trash cans. I turned around to watch it go, and it was gone. Am I light enough to lift? Oh, am I light enough? Am I light enough to lift? Oh, am I light enough? When I was a kid, I used to climb to the top crook of a tall pine. In the woods, behind the house, late at night. Overhead, a flock of lights passing by. Am I light enough to lift? Oh, am I light enough? Am I light enough to lift? Oh, am I light enough? But I don't want to climb anymore. I don't want to leave. Oh, I'm ready to come down now. Oh, I'm ready now. I can't calm down. I can't calm down. I'm ready now to come back to the ground. I'm ready now to put my weight on a day. Oh, help me down now. Help me down to the ground. Oh, help me down, dear.
So after doing poetry readings, when did you pick up the guitar? Was it always something in the background?
And it was, it was parallel. And down in Asheville, it was really where I was introduced to music of the sort that I now listen to and play. And it was through.
Who were some of the bands?
The big one was definitely Will Oldham. It was a very significant discovery for me, and something that I still delight in hearing every day. But
how old were you?
19, 20.
I mean, what was it like to discover, like, your guy?
It was terrific. And, I mean, Will Oldham and Cat Power, Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah.
These bands I still love. I mean, it was... It's an odd fact of music, right? That you don't really... Until you discover something that you... something that you respond to, you don't know it exists, but once it does exist, it's...
Yeah, it's hard to explain.
Right?
It's like there was a before and there was an after.
It's kind of, it's like... Yeah, I mean, I didn't know I didn't like the music that I was already familiar with until I found stuff that I actually did appreciate. Yeah, you know?
Makes sense. So you said they were running parallel.
Yeah, music. So I was kind of just playing and learning to play music and writing music... They kind of went together. So when I would learn a new chord or a new chord progression or melody or something I wanted to get inside of, something that would, especially in music that I heard, or I would write songs and in the process of learning how to play music. Mm-hmm. So they always went together. Rather than say, I mean, I did learn how to basically play the guitar from learning songs that I like to listen to, but I would, in learning different chord patterns or different chord structures, I would write songs in order to learn how to play those chord structures and things. So,
and when did you start to make the shift to do more
to music?
To music, and I mean, do you still perform poetry?
No, not I don't even write it, and I was never quite satisfied with it. I couldn't. There's a William Carlos Williams, like often quoted by Robert Creeley, would say, you know, to get said what must get said, and I thought I could do that through poetry, but I never quite felt that satisfaction. Most of my friends, I really admired their writing, and I wanted to participate in that way, but it's too bad because I put so much time into it, and traveling around and writing and writing and writing, and for it kind of to not be all that good. And I don't mean that in some coy, mock self-critical way. I mean, I'm comfortable saying that it's not all that terrific. But I enjoy playing music, and I can spend an entire day doing it. I've always wanted to. I mean, anybody wants a purpose or something to give him or herself to, and that's what I feel with music, and I don't question it in that way, and it's such a comfort, and I never felt that with poetry. It was a little you know, it took some kind of effort,
right? And yeah. This just seems like an effortless, yeah. It just kind of pours out,
yeah, and I enjoy it. I don't, you know, and I'm not entirely concerned with what comes of it in that way. I'm not uncertain about it, right? I don't feel embarrassed playing a song for you, you know?
Did you feel embarrassed reading poetry?
I didn't feel embarrassed reading it, but there was something about the voicing that that wasn't quite full.
And what were...
It was inhibited, and I was... after a life of inhibition and being held back in one way or another, it's nice to find something that I feel some facility or comfort or pride in. Okay.
And what were people who were who knew you during that time reaction to you being like, well, now I play songs?
Well, we all play, especially in Buffalo, which is where I really started to play music, in Buffalo, New York. I lived there for a couple of years. Everybody was doing, a few of my friends there anyway, were doing both poetry and music, you know. And not poetry in the sense of, you know, we're not like wearing what are those neckties called? Not ascots, but
kerchiefs,
cravat. You know, okay. Or you know, we weren't.
I only knew two things.
You know what I mean? We weren't wearing velvet jackets. You know, yeah. It wasn't this sense of, you know, these are people who live in, you know, they live in Buffalo. You know, they're these. They have families. They have their communities of people, and it. There was something about it that was so atypical about the ways that one would imagine a poet or something, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, they weren't there wasn't, it wasn't heavy-handed or anything. But everybody sang songs and played music, and that's kind of what developed out of it.
Why don't we hear another song?
Okay, yeah.
What do you want to play?
This is the most recent song I have. It's a week old.
Great.
Never heard by anybody.
Oh, perfect.
In all of the rooms I've lived, I filled the walls with all the pictures I can find of faces with you in them somewhere. Somewhere in the jawline. Somewhere in the bright and open eyes, I find you, I find you when you find me. You and me along in time, me and you along in time. In the radiator, hidden on the ceiling fan blade, you say you are not alone, not dead yet. Sometime in the middle day, somehow in my own way, I find you. When you find me, I find you when you find me. You and me along in time, you and me along in time. Me and you along in time. Me and you along in time. We have such a long, long time. We have such a long, long, long time. We have such a long, long time. We are such a long time.
It's great. What's it called?
Ferrier.
Oh.
Yeah. Named after the singer, like Kathleen Ferrier. She's a classical singer from England.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of recording solo and then with groups.
Yeah.
And it seems like you can go back and forth pretty easily. How do you decide which material gets what treatment? Or
yeah, I wish it was. I wish it was that. I wish it was that formal, but and it's more about circumstances. Mm. I would love to be playing with the people I played with in Asheville, mm-hmm. Shane Parrish, especially guitar player. He played on the album Loyalty that was just reissued on Friday, October 30th.
Congratulations!
Thank you. I'm really happy about that, especially because of what it shows of the interaction with these musicians. And also Jay Seeger, who's a musician. Shane Parrish, Jay Seeger, and Emily Easterly, who all played on the album. They all make music on their own. I love what they produced and what they contributed to the music as much as I love spending time with them. And I'd be so happy to have those other elements in the music, you know. I like to sing, and a lot of these songs I've been playing were written on this guitar, kind of for this format, just because of the circumstances of my life here, which is, you know, as anybody, relatively small room.
Yeah.
Need to kind of keep it quiet. limited time for recording. So
And why did you, or how did you end up in Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Well, I'm from Boston, and I like living in the Northeast. I wanted to come back after living in the South for 10, 12 years. But I didn't want to live in Massachusetts, as anybody who's from there probably feels. Yeah.
Or spent a weekend there.
And there I go. I just lost the state. I mean, you know, whatever.
It's okay.
I don't know.
They lost us a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, go Sox. and all the reasons aside, I've never felt more comfortable in a place than I've felt living in Greenpoint. And I'm not 20. It's like, you know, I've lived in a lot of different places and I'm absolutely comfortable here.
It's great. Yeah.
It's
there too. Yeah.
It's a rhythm. It's a rhythm that I appreciate. It makes sense to me. I don't feel alienated.
No.
Yeah.
Other parts I do, but there it's just kind of quiet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, anywhere here.
So the record was reissued. Any gigs coming up or shows where people can
actually, yeah,
can come see you?
Yeah, now that you mention it. I'm playing, the record release show is at Union Pool on Wednesday.
Amazing.
I'm playing with June West, who actually sings a little bit on the new album. Just a song or two. And this guy, Will Stratton, who lives in upstate New York, who I met through a mutual friend. But yeah, it should be a fun night.
Great.
Yeah.
So where can people get the record, hear it, buy it, follow you, find
you? So it's out on Cinderlin, Capture Tracks, Omnia Music Group.
Love Capture Tracks. Thing.
Oh, yeah, me too. They're in my neighborhood too. So you can find it at the Capture Tracks store, obviously, but online, and I think it's fully distributed. It's on record and CD and tape.
Amazing.
And digital, yeah.
You know, who has tape players? I mean, I love a good tape release, but like who...
Yeah. I was talking to my friend about that. It's like, I think there are definitely like 1,000 people.
Yeah.
But well, just 1,000.
But
you know,
like,
not like thousand. You know, it's like there are who listen to tapes.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably like the run of most tapes.
Do you think that they have like old Walkman and like with spare parts just to just like.
I like tapes, but yeah, I mean, I have a tape player, but I just got my old tape player down from when I was visiting North Carolina, but I don't know.
Darren's car in LA is my parents' old car, and he has a tape player, and we were just home a few weeks ago, and we found all of our old mixtapes from the 90s. So, like, sweet. Yeah.
I still think about tapes that I've had that break down, obviously, but they don't break down as much as CDs, for example.
No.
That's something that I think I could definitely do without, especially now that... If you're listening to something digitally, which is terrific, you know, it's so convenient and easy and great, but I don't know why you would. The CD is just a very cumbersome delivery system for digital.
Yeah, it feels like
material. Right?
It feels like once you rip it, if you still have the ability to, then you just have like a dead body, like you've taken the soul, and it's just like you're like, oh, okay. Anyway, let's.
You don't feel this thing where you're like. I got to listen to it on CD.
No.
You know?
No one's ever said that.
I care about this music. I want to listen to it on CD.
Yeah.
It was just, anyway.
Well, thanks for coming.
I'm happy that they put it out on CD.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike and Cinderlin.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks to Howling Rays. Congratulations again on the brick and mortar. We will be off the next 2 weeks and then we'll be back with a pre-Thanksgiving episode. Jay, what are you going to take us out with?
I'm going to take us out with a song called Me and G.
Oh, perfect. thanks for listening to Snacky Tunes, and here we go.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, G.
Yeah.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you all you people out there eating dinner. Began criminal
living close to the ground, to the ground. And now, in the bright today, we start to raise. Don't break, don't break down. It's your only life, your only life. And someone's coming over tonight. Did I stay alone too long for love to find me a home? Did I stay alone too long for love to find me a new home? For my only life, my only life. Someone's coming over tonight. I hope you're coming over. Did I stay alone too long for love to find me a home? Did I stay alone too long for love to find me a new home? For my only life, my only life. Someone's coming over now. I'm coming around, I'm coming around 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 now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.